Thanks for downloading this podcast. It's for personal use only and must not be broadcast, reproduced, or used in any form without permission.
Tell your friends they can get their own copy wherever they get their podcasts.
Delivering all the news, the informed views, and just telling great motorsport stories since 2003. Powered by the racetalk.com. This is On the Grid.
G'day everyone and welcome to another episode of On the Grid here on mypodcasthouse.com or on the radio show limited RS1. Thank you for joining us. A big show coming your way very shortly. Richard Crowell to catch up with Geordie Roddy. If you haven't heard that name before, you want to stay tuned and listen. This is a great chat with a man who is into Indy cars. He's got some, he's driven them, all that sort of stuff. Richard will go through that and it'll be a very good interview, I can guarantee you. Then Richard and Mark join me to talk about what's happened in the week of motorsport, our hots and nots, all that to come right here on the grid.
You're listening to the latest from around the motorsport world.
On the grid.
Well, up until last weekend, our first guest in the show this week was the most successful IndyCar driver from the Antipodes this season, with a strong performance in some historic IndyCar racing on the streets of Long Beach. But Jordan Roddy's story goes a lot deeper than that, and I'm thrilled to say he's joining us on the grid this week for a chat. Jordan, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming in, and I'm going to start right off the top by saying what an amazing performance it must have been for you at Long Beach. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. I went there with no real expectations. Sort of, I bought the car hoping to do some track days with it, basically, and to have the opportunity to take it to an event where the car had previously had success in the main race, and to compete with it rather than just doing a demo. It was actually some races, and to come away with some podiums was a very pleasant surprise. I never really expected that.
We'll talk more about that in a minute, but just to backtrack a little bit, for those that follow Australian motorsport closely, they'll be familiar with the Roddy surname. Your dad, Mike, has been heavily involved in the sport for a long time. You have as well. But just give us the short version of the Roddy story when it comes to Australian motorsport.
My dad started getting involved club racing in the 90s, where he's always been a Jaguar V12. Anything, particularly XJSs, it sort of got us into the sport as a family. So we started off doing club events and then state race series in Victoria. It sort of became a bit of a monster that grew out of. I sort of looked to find different ways to make a career out of cars, and it's always involved motor racing in different capacities. I try not to take it too seriously, and I try to sort of keep it fun and light, but it inevitably, with every approach that I take, it inevitably and invariably gets out of control quickly, as it sort of has with the Lola that we ran at Long Beach.
Yeah. Where did the family's fascination with Jaguars come from? Because I distinctly remember standing on the pit wall at Oran Park, great old place that it was, and having my ears blown apart by a V12, must have been an XJS sports sedan at a Shannon's round way back when. But where did the Jag fascination come from?
Back in the 60s, my grandfather, Poppy Ned, he had a Mark IV saloon, and Dad, as a young boy, just was infatuated by the car, from owning that car, it became a lifelong obsession that Dad ended up going and working for Peter Manton, who most people with a knowledge of Australian motorsport from the 60s would know all about. Peter sort of being he was the mini driver in Team Neptune. He was Peter Manton Motors, so he was, you know, the Australian distributor of, the Victorian distributor of Jensen cars, and a name synonymous with high end cars and motor racing in the 60s and 70s in Victoria. So dad did an apprenticeship there, and there he was exposed to working on brand new Jags, and he was still a teenager at the time, and he just built up and up and up until around the time I was born. He started his own business, and the business focused on Jags, and I sort of took on the disease as well, and I tried a few different career paths. I spent some time in aviation, and I spent some time in the engineering side of aerospace as well, and in every instance of me trying a separate pathway, I've realized I've had much more fun playing with cars, and I inevitably end up playing back with cars again.
It is an incredibly addictive business. So I can attest to that for sure. So run us through some of the cool machines that the families own, because there's been some unbelievable things, and maybe start with the 85 Bathurst TWR Jag that was a really prominent part of historic Group A and C racing in Australia for quite some time.
Yeah, well, we've sort of always had an obsession with 12-cylinder powered Jags. So the sort of the holy grail for us, for Dad and I, really, because Dad just wasn't hunting it. I was hunting it too, and I was, you know, I was only a teenager when we got it. We wanted, look, we didn't specifically want the Bathurst winning car, but we just wanted a Group A original Walkinshaw XJS, of which there were four. The car that the Jaguar Daimler Heritage Trust has right now is the car that we initially tried to buy and just missed out on. And the next car we had a crack at is the car that we ended up with, and we were just so fortunate. It was the car with probably the most favourable history for an Australian Jaguar enthusiast. So it being a Bathurst winner, and we had the car for 17 years. It almost became a sibling to me, that thing. Mm. I'm sort of lucky. I drove it a few times as well. Dad did most of the running in it. But for me, as someone who sort of grew up as a four-year-old watching the 85 Bathurst 7-Sport VHS video over and over and over, to the point where I actually wore the VHS cassette out. Yeah, really cool to be fortunate enough to turn some laps in it and actually have it as part of our family, that car. It was, beyond dream level stuff.
And you took it to Goodwood. What was that like?
Yeah, we were sort of lucky, through my involvement with the family business over, the last, couple of, years, managed to make some good friends throughout the world, and not that long ago, probably a couple of years ago, I was introduced to the guys from Goodwood, and one thing led to another with that, and we were offered the opportunity to take it to the Festival of Speed last year, and we already had a good relationship with Gossy, who was of course one of the original 85 drivers for the car, but we sort of had an established relationship with Armin Hahner, who was the co-driver, but we didn't have his current contact details. So we eventually found him, and it was funny, the year before actually at Goodwood, I bumped into him in a taxi queue at the 2022 Goodwood Festival of Speed.
Right.
And that was sort of where I jokingly suggested that we would get the car back the following year with Gossy and him, and it was just an idea that we chatted about it as a joke initially, and it got out of control, and it eventually happened 12 months later. That was another just unbelievable series of discussions that sort of gathered momentum and very quickly became reality.
Such a cool experience. I can only imagine how special that must have been, especially reuniting those two boys with such an iconic racing car. I could ask you a thousand questions about the cars that you have been involved in and your family's been involved in. And People can jump on your Instagram and see them all. It's a fantastic Instagram account. Definitely live vicariously through some of the stuff you're doing. But before I talk about the Newman Haas Lola, I want to ask you about the Cadillac LMP1 car, because that was a car in the day that fascinated me. And I remember being at Race of a Thousand Years in Adelaide and seeing the Motorola cars that Dams run back in the day and being interested in those factory cars. How did you come to end up with one of those, and what are the plans for that car?
Well, I was actually at a Race of a Thousand Years as well myself. I was 13 and we were running one of Dad's XJS, his original black XJS sports sedan. And same thing, I saw that car at Adelaide in, was it 99, 2000, and just it was sort of one of the main underdogs up against the Audi, apart from obviously the Panos. And yeah, same thing, super cool car. I just fell in love with it. And it was sort of, there's been a lot of cars in my life where I sort of made a note in the back of my mind, geez, I'd love to own that someday. And never really expected to get the opportunity to own it. But this is one instance where by a twist of fate and some of the best cars I've ever owned were cars that I didn't actually go looking for. They sort of found me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This is definitely an instance of a car that found me. I heard about it through the grapevine that a car collection in Florida was selling off some significant GM racing cars, and just did a little bit of digging around based on the rumor, and to my surprise, one of them was the original chassis three Cadillac LMP. It wasn't one of the Dams cars that came to Adelaide in 2000, but it was one of the Works US based cars that it only ever did four races. Actually, it, wow. It did Le Mans, Petit Le Mans, Sebring 12 Hour, and Daytona 24. So, four races to do. That's a pretty good list.
Incredible.
And then it was updated to the 2001 spec, which was a massive sort of wholesale re-engineering of the car, to the point where you can't actually take a car back to 2000 spec if it's been taken to 2001 spec. There's that many modifications, especially even to the monocoque. So it became a test car in 2001, I've gone ahead and we've restored it back to 2001 spec, and it's not far off running now. It's on the water to the UK right now. So we did all the chassis and gearbox suspension and bodywork restoration here in Australia, and the engine is almost finished in the UK right now, and we'll get it running in the UK once the engine is finished, in probably in the next sort of 6 to 8 weeks, and I don't know what the plans are beyond that, beyond getting it running, but it'd be great to see the car at some events like Le Mans Classic and specifically Peter Auto events. It's a good friend of mine runs the Endurance Racing Legends historic category there.
Yeah.
And it's you know, the tracks and the fields that they get are just unbelievable. So to be a part of that would be another dream come true. And it's something we'll inch towards as time goes on.
It was a really special era of prototype racing, that with the dominant Audis and the really unique Panos, the Cadillacs chipping away, the Olive Garden Raffinelli Judd V8, it's still the loudest racing car I reckon I've ever heard in my life, that thing around the Adelaide street. So, and it feels like we're in another really special era of sports car racing now. So how do you get support to rebuild a 2001 spec Cadillac LMP1 car? Because I can't imagine information and spare parts supply and things like that grows on trees for those things.
Well, yeah, look, I've been lucky where I've had a good sort of, I guess you'd call it an apprenticeship. I've restored a lot of racing cars prior to this one that were a great sort of lead-in to this one. So this is definitely the most complex, drawn out and detailed restoration I've ever had to do. But at the end of the day, it's still just a car with four wheels and an engine. So you just go back to first principles with everything. So a lot of time digging on the telephone, you know, I'm almost nocturnal. I don't really sleep. I spend a lot of time, particularly with cars like with this one, tracking down original team members, and invariably everybody has at the very least some useful information, but sometimes they even have parts. Through that, and if you just keep ringing and ringing and ringing and digging and digging, eventually you find either the parts or information that you need. It's always out there. And sometimes you come up short, but we're so lucky that in this modern age, there's so many wonderful rapid prototyping technologies. You know, we've had to 3D print a few things for the car, but wow, but they were only fairly minor things. It's a good time to be restoring cars like that with the technology that we have. And I had a few very fortunate phone calls where people actually heard about me having the car and rang me out of the blue. There's a guy called Willy Billy who lives about 3 miles from Le Mans.
Wow. Yeah,
an ex-DAMS employee, and he tracked me down and he had some of the parts that I needed.
Oh wow.
It's funny. It's funny how it all sort of transpires with these restorations, but I'm lucky that I'd done, you know, things like XJR15s and other, you know, like the GT1 Murcielago that I did a few years ago.
Yeah.
Things like that were all a really good prelude to doing this, because just about everything that I'd done up to date had given me different skills necessary to tackle this one, which was huge.
Yeah, I'd forgotten about the Mercy. We could do an entire podcast on that car alone. All right, we need to talk Indy cars, because I remember being a young bloke very early in my career, having a great opportunity on the streets of Surfers Paradise in 2006 to call that race with my good buddy Wade Ornger for the big screen PA coverage. 2006 Lexmark Indy 300. It was won by Sebastian Bourdais in a McDonald's Newman Haas Lola Champ car. Glorious era, incredible cars, and you now own that car. Arguably one of the most successful Champ car / Indy cars the sport has seen in terms of a single chassis. Just walk us through the process of going through that massive Newman Haas auction that I reckon every person in the sport looked at and dreamt. What sort of led to that process to end up with that car?
Well, interestingly, I don't think anyone ever gets the chance to do this very often, but I'll correct you on a history matter there.
Please.
So my car's actually not the 06 winner; it's the 05 winner.
05, right? Well, I didn't. Call
so my car is actually the one that he shunted in practice.
As
a precaution, they didn't know if he damaged the tub or not. So as a precaution, they built up the spare car for him, and he ran that for the rest of the weekend. And my car was actually, the tub was sent back to Lola in England, and they said there was nothing wrong with it, and it went back to Newman Haas. But
of course, because Nelson Philippe won the 06 race, didn't he?
Yeah, off the top of my head. This is the car that won the 05 race, and by winning the race, he won the championship on the day. And that's specifically why I really wanted this car, because I was generally always in high school or in university, I studied engineering, and always around exam time, Indy would be on.
Yep.
So I always missed out, and I'd sit there at home glued to the telly. And I can just remember watching this race. This particular era of Cham cars, I was obsessed with them. I loved that late Lola with the notched upside pod, and they were just so long and sort of lean and sinewy looking. There was something about the form of them I was obsessed with, and to have this car sort of the one that dominated in that era and won the championship by winning in Australia when they announced the Newman Haas auction, where all of the cars that Newman Haas had retained would be sold in one big auction, I should say. A buddy of mine actually worked for RM Sotheby's at the time, and he was one of the guys in charge of running the auction, and he knew that I wanted this car. So I sort of didn't seriously consider buying it, but I obviously really wanted it. A combination of him egging me on, the auction was, my lot came up at around 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning. It was a combination of him egging me on, and it being 4 a.m. on a Sunday morning with a bit of impaired judgment that I ended up with the thing. But it was meant to be, because whilst I probably had a panic attack initially, and in fact, Mark, my mate from RM, will attest that I did actually have a panic attack when I first bought it because I had no idea what I was going to do with it. I didn't even know if I would fit in it. In fact, at the time, I wouldn't fit in it. I've had to go on a bit of a fitness regime in the last sort of year or two to make myself fit in the car. Yeah, it's just it's one of those things where you initially don't know why you did it or what you were doing it for, but there was just a reason for it, and I've managed to track down most of the original Newman Haas crew members, and they're helping me run the car now. So it's just so cool. You show up at the track, and there's one guy who was the rear end mechanic on the car for Seb back in 05 and 06, a guy called Mikey Hart Graves, and we actually figured out. When I was at Long Beach last weekend, we figured out that chassis has never been to a racetrack without Mikey on the tools. With
wow,
it.
Really?
Yeah, not once. Yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah. It's not just the car, it's the people that I've managed to get around the whole thing. Like even today, a former Cosworth track support engineer rang me up and said, I was at weekend and it was just so awesome to see the car running again, and now he wants to get involved in the project and see how he can help. And you know, he's a wealth of information on basically XF, XD, X, sorry XD, XF and XFE generation of the 2.65 litre turbo Cosi V8s.
Yeah,
so just, you know, just it's amazing. Even in the aftermath after Long Beach last weekend, we're still getting original people that worked with the car coming out of the woodwork and wanting to be a part of it.
There's an amazing video on Racer that Marshall Pruitt, who's a friend of us, has done, where he gets Craig Hampson along to do a walkthrough around the car. And obviously Craig was integral to Sebastian winning all those championships back in Champ Car. And his passion for the car is visible from the moment he walks up to it with Marshall, which is so nice to see. So those things were, if memory serves, 700 odd kilos, if not a little bit less. And on full boost, near as makes a difference, 1,000 horsepower. What's it like to drive?
Look, it's I've driven some pretty fast sort of cars, you know, in the past, you know, lots of GT3 cars. I drove the GT1 Mercy, and probably the fastest car I've actually been running is I've got a little Wolf, yep. APS prototype car, and that, you know, it doesn't have heaps of power. It's only making about 240 horsepower, but it's got masses of aero grip, and amongst all of the, you know, the GT things and prototype things that I've driven in the past, this is just in, I wouldn't even say it's in a different league. It's in a league above a different league. Yeah. You know, when the thing comes on boost in second or third gear, I was talking to the boys at Long Beach about it. It's kind of like one of those scenes from like Star Trek or Star Wars, whatever, when they put the spaceship into warp drive and all the stars just become like a white line blur.
Amazing.
No joke. Like the palm trees at Long Beach just became green smudges in my eyes. It was unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah. It's such a cool era of racing car. And I remember talking to Will Power about this, and even he sits back and goes, yeah, they were the peak of the Champ Cars and Indy Cars that he got to drive.
It's funny you mentioned that. So Will was, I was suiting up to jump in the car, I think for the first race on the Saturday, and Will was walking past and he saw my car and stopped in his tracks. Yeah. and walked over and immediately sort of had to chat. And it turns out he's bought his first Lola, the Aussie Vineyards car, I think it was.
Is he really?
And yeah, well, that's what he's. I'm pretty sure. Look, there was a lot of noise in the background, and I was putting my helmet on at the time. But the gist I got was that yeah, he's bought it back, wow. and that he's looking to make it run. And he's also got his first his championship winning Formula Holden that's over in the States with him now, and he's restoring that too. Even to see Will's, you know, because he would see it all on a daily basis. You know, he's been a Penske driver for years now, and deals with the best of the best, and is part of just that whole Penske juggernaut. But even now, when someone like Will Power sees one of these mid-noughties era or early noughties era champ cars with a living, breathing Cozzy in the back. Even he has stopped in his tracks and just can't walk past it. So that tells you a lot about the emotional power that it has on people that drove them.
Yeah, that was such a phenomenal era of racing car. And then talk us through the weekend, mate, and the historic races at Long Beach against a really, really cool field and some cool names as well. What was that like?
Well, look, it was all by accident, really. I had a phone call probably around Christmas time from my friend in Chicago that helps me look after the car, Donnie Hovel, who was an ex-Newman Haas crew chief. And he said, would you like to run the car at Long Beach in April? And I thought he was joking initially, but it pretty quickly became apparent that it was real. And I'd only ever driven the car once prior, and that was a sort of a really, really sort of shortened test day where I was running the car on green slicks on a wet track, and it was almost pointless beyond just proving that the car was now running and working, and we were just checking that it had gears and that it could sort of function. It was basically just a shakedown, and we barely even shook the thing down. So to then, not having any experience in a similar car, the car's barely turned a wheel since it was restored. Then to take it straight to, you know, the main IndyCar race at Long Beach with all those concrete walls, with no experience for me, and not knowing if the car would behave itself or not. Just so many variables. It was a bold decision to make, but I sort of thought, well, Christ, we have to do it because it's once in a lifetime sort of a thing, especially Long Beach rotates the historic support category every year, and it probably will never happen again. So yeah, we took the plunge and threw everybody in at the deep end, especially myself. And thank God I didn't crash the thing because it's all original. The car, it's right down to the coatings on the wishbones, the paint, the stickers, everything. It's as it left Newman Haas, and even when they restored the car, they were really sympathetic to the originality of the car and made sure that they didn't renew anything unless it absolutely needed to be renewed. That was all constantly in the back of my mind. Here's me, an absolute noob who probably didn't really deserve to be in the cars. You know, I feel like a car like that, you should serve an apprenticeship. You should earn your way into it. And here's me, who's definitely not earned their way into the car. I just thought, number one, first and foremost, is to keep the car straight and clean. And second goal is to have fun. Anything beyond those two points would be a massive bonus. Yeah.
Oh, mate, well, I think you achieved that. Last one, what's the future hold for that car in particular and for you? What are the boxes you want to tick from a driving point of view with that incredible car?
I'm not very good at planning things. So I tend to sort of let things happen in front of me, and opportunities come up and we just grab them when they fly past. But I would love to do some iconic tracks with the car. So we're currently having discussions the last few days about finding some track time at Road America.
Uh-huh.
We want to do some more testing with the car. There's a few things that we want to work on, and I want to become more familiar with the car, because at Long Beach, you know, there was I drove the car at probably I'd call it like 6.5, 7 tenths, because you can't really go to a place like that and try and learn a car like that as well as learning the track. There's far too much risk. So I don't really feel like I've begun to learn the car yet. So I'd love to go to a track where there's a little bit of runoff. You know, Road America is still a very, very fast and dangerous track, but it has some sand traps, which Long Beach doesn't have any of. Sure. So, I didn't even bother left foot braking the car at Long Beach, just starting to properly drive the thing and begin to explore its performance properly, which we never did last weekend. So either that or Laguna Seca would be my two top picks.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. We've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you very much for joining us and telling some of your story, Jordan. Really appreciate it. And I think from motorsport fans everywhere, thanks for doing this with these amazing cars, because a lot of people get a lot of joy out of seeing what you're doing and these incredible cars, some of them incredibly unique, really cool racing cars coming back to life and being used as they're intended to be used, which is great. So well done. Congratulations and thanks. And thanks for joining us to talk about some of your story.
No, look, thank you very much, mate. It's a big part of my passion for cars is sharing them with, you know, I believe cars like that, they shouldn't have the wheels raced off them, but they should be raced. And I think it's a balance between letting everyone else, including myself, enjoy the car and perhaps not overusing it. And we're trying to find the balance with that car. And I was blown away with the enthusiasm for it at Long Beach, and we'll get it out again and see if we can make some more cozy noises.
Oh, it's a great noise to make. Jordan, thanks for your time. Really appreciate you joining me on the show.
Thank you.
There's more great motorsport stories coming next on The Grid.
Top of the second part of our program, Richard Crail. G'day to you.
Shebexter, how are you?
Good. Ripper chat.
Great chat. Jordan Roddy. The Roddy family, one of the many unsung motor racing families in Australian motorsport, but I love the fact, and we talked about it at the end of our chat there, that these guys are buying racing cars. Yes, that's great. A lot of people buy cool racing cars, but they're actually using them as they were designed to do, which I think is just stupendously good. So full kudos to Jordan and to his dad, Mike, and for what they're doing there. I need to mention that you can follow Jordan on Instagram. His Instagram account, you'll live vicariously through, but it's at Bespoke Motorcars, all one word. It's a green sort of logo. You can't miss it. There's some really cool stuff on there about not just the Lola Champ car, but the Cadillac LMP1 car, the Bentley Conti GT3 car, like the Bathurst 12-hour winner. There's an SLS AMG on there. There's some stuff he's doing with the prototype he talked about. And also the ongoing build of a V12 XKRS Jag sports sedan that Mike is going to run at some point in Australian sports sedan racing. So highly recommended you jump on and follow that. And we thank Jordan for his time. Really, really cool story and cool guy and doing cool things with cool racing cars. So I'm here for it.
Mark Walker, good day to you.
Hanny Shebeki, Richard Crail, how's the jet lag going there, little buddy?
Yeah, those 2 hours, I'd rather fly to America. It's easy to get over that because you're just in such a completely different time zone. But no, we're going good. Nice to be back.
Might have something to do with the time you spent at Sydney Airport. That stuff's
young. Oh, it's purgatory, that place, isn't it? Really horrible. Went to a lot of airports in the last couple of weeks, Shebex, and Mascot just continues to let the side down.
Yeah.
It's a really disappointing place to arrive into a great country like Australia. Seriously, it's just crushingly disappointing that
it's
Mascot
cold,
is what half of the people that come into this country land at Mascot, and they must be just like, oh, well, this place is a bloody awful. Like, what's the rest of the country going to be like? And then you've got to drive in Sydney. Oh, it's no good. Anyway, I could rant about that for an entire podcast, but this isn't a travel show. It's a motorsport show.
It is a motorsport show, and there's a couple of stories doing the rounds at the moment that I'd love to get your thoughts on. First of all, the possibility of Betty selling Erebus.
Any thoughts on that, Mark?
After the way that things have gone this year, could you blame her if she wanted to get out?
No,
probably not. I mean, it's turned from what outwardly you'd assume would be a reasonably profitable little venture they had going on there last year to something that doesn't have a whole lot of sponsorship now. So, if she wants out, it's probably a time to do it. Everyone's like, Pete, buy it, Pete. Get at it and go in there and buy it, mate. He's had so many opportunities over the years to buy teams. If he wanted a team, he could have bought one any stage of the ball game over the years. But we'll see. There'll be people sniffing around for sure that'll be keen to have a go if indeed the team or the licenses or whatever have you is on the market.
I suppose the interesting one is what else is there for them to do? And if you're Betty and you're the one that certainly this season's going to be putting money into it because it's definitely not sustaining itself as a business this year, there's no way it can, having lost that amount of sponsorship. You've won Bathurst. You've contended at Bathurst in other years. Very nearly won it last year. You've won the championship now. You've been at the pointy end of pit lane. You've brought great drivers through. Like, what other boxes are there for her to tick? You could very reasonably understand if she did bail right now, because 100%. She's ticked all the boxes.
Yeah. And the worst part about it is this should have been the year that the team actually made a lot of money.
Oh, well, maybe.
When you win the Drivers' Championship and you win the Team's Championship, you should be doing pretty well year after.
I don't think it's ever been about making money, though, either. No. It's about, like, she wouldn't have spent all those money on those Mercs if it wanted to be a profit-generating exercise. But certainly the business needed to stand on its own two feet. I'm sure any sensible business person would operate that way. But so I don't necessarily think it's about the profit, but... you know, if it's now, it's become difficult, I'm sure it's not that fun. And ultimately, I think you get the impression that that's what it's all about for Betty. It's that challenge. It's that fun. It's wanting to win. She's ticked all the boxes. Couldn't, you know, you would forgive her for selling it and moving on and doing something else with her life out on the farm she's got. And the other thing is that you'd have to think that it's probably a reasonably good market to sell in at the moment, because there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of people sniffing around the sport. Wrecks are hard to come by. Licenses are hard to come by. So that you'd think there'd be some demand for both the IP that is Erebus, that is the race team, that are the people and the facilities and the racing cars, but then also the licenses that come with it. So certainly wouldn't have a bath selling the thing either.
I mean, she's been a wonderful benefactor for the sport. You go back to the F3 days and then the GTs after that. So, you know, if she wanted to remain in the sport, there's many outlets that she could still be involved with. It, you know, selling out of supercars doesn't necessarily mean that she'll be lost to the sport, I hope.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm pretty certain she's still got one of the SLSs from the SLS era. I think they still own the 13-12-hour winner. You could roll that thing out in the trophy class and it'd still be competitive. Like, you could do just about anything. So, yeah, hopefully, if that's the way it goes, she's not lost to it. But who knows? Maybe Barry Ryan is involved in a buyout somehow and ends up running it himself. I don't know. Like, there's so many possibilities there. Or maybe they just keep chuffing on and rebuild the thing again, as they've done several times over the journey. Like, that team has been reinvented, what, four times now? Three times at least. Yeah. So the big reinvention from the Mercs, and then the big reinvention sort of at the end of the Penrite and Reynolds era, and now another one to get to where they are now. So, yeah, it's an interesting story. Ironically, the book has just literally just been launched about the 10-year journey. So the timing of that is fairly cosmic as well.
Yeah, certainly is. And speaking of Erebus too, great to see that Brody Kostecki's going to jump in a TAE car, a Trans Am car, in the TA2 series, and teammate with Todd Hazelwood.
Yeah, how good's Trans Am going to be at Taylor Bean in a couple of weeks? I mean, it's like eight of the supercar field there, and James Moffat. It's Roboth. It's awesome. It's a great field. That's going to be hilarious. Must watch.
Must watch.
No, but good.
Sorry, Mark.
But even then, like, you've got guys like Ben Grice who aren't supercars drivers who...
No, totally.
Totally, you know, except Ben will, you know, step on a black cat under a ladder and break the mirrors and all that sort of jazz, and the thing will implode itself before the races. But if Benny can have a decent run, which he's absolutely overdue for, he'll be absolutely in the mix too. And the thing with the Ben too, running on the West Circuit, that should be a bit of fun.
Yeah, I'm actually for that. I quite like it. I've had the fortune to drive that racetrack, and it's a very different style circuit to the international track. I mean, it's done primarily, there's a cost saving initiative involved here in that it's cheaper to hire. It's cheaper to cover from a TV point of view as well. They're all factors that have to be considered in promoting motorsport these days. But I like the fact it's different. The Bend's got 57 different layouts. Why don't we use more than just the international track? And when the supercars went there in 2020 for the second part of that doubleheader, it was genuinely entertaining racing. It was a really good racetrack for car racing. Big stop down the hill there at turn six. changes the character of the circuit a lot. So it is like a completely different racetrack, which I think is really cool. So, yeah, I'm all for it. I think it'll be good. Mix things up a little bit.
You know, you keep the cars in front of the spectators more, so yep. you can't see the other side of the hill there when you're on the international circuit, which is a good thing for everyone who's over on the pit building around that side of the track.
Yeah.
But you're not really losing many overtaking spots either. You're sort of gaining one. Well, the one you lose at the hairpin, you gain at that hard stop.
Yeah, I think it's a better passing place than turn six on the long track, to be honest. Mm. Like it's a bigger stop with a tighter corner. No, I'm here for it. We've got to mix things up a little bit. You know, we keep doing the same thing over and over again in our sport. So why not try something just a little bit different? And the drivers will complain. And I've seen some quotes from Tony D'Alberto saying he's massively disappointed. And that's fine. I get that. They love getting the jollies on the high speed turn 7, 8, 9 and 10 complex. And it's a great sequence of corners. And I'm sure it's brilliant to drive in a TCR car or especially a GT3 car. But ultimately, there's more than just the racing car drivers going out there and driving the cars at these events. There's a TV product and there's a crowd component now, genuine crowds going to Shannon's rounds. So I think that all needs to be taken into account. And I think the drivers will ultimately enjoy the challenge of a different racetrack as well.
Did I see that there's going to be a club round later in the year on the full 7.77K long track?
Yes. Yep.
That'll be fun.
Yep. Yep.
It'll be a thing.
It will be a thing. I think there are corners out there that are pretty spectacular. The Asian Le Mans series out the back there was bloody cool.
It's a lot closer to the spectator sort of vantage points in a lot of spots. You're actually right on the track, yep. which is something you don't get on the main sort of circuit.
Yeah, yep, you're right on top of the cars. So yeah, it would be really good. There's some chatter about doing a state round on the east circuit, which is just that back part of the racetrack.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, totally. And like for Hyundai Excels and even improved production and things like that on there, they would be mega. It'd be really, really good. So, no, I'm okay with it. I like mixing it up and I really like the West Track. It's a good racy racetrack. So I think that's going to be a cracking Shannon's round. Big GT field, I'm sure. Porsche Sprint Challenges, the blockbuster category. So they'll be there. What else is there? GT4, I think Australian production cars are running, Trans Am and TCR. Like, that's a properly good race program.
Yeah.
That really good. And I think Sport Sedans as well, aren't they? I think they might be there too.
But look, you look at where the Shannon Speed Series was last year with the Virat Touring cars and the S5000s, which were battling for grids.
Mm.
I haven't lost anything. You know, we've picked up GT4, which already have healthy grids and they're going to be good racing when we get a few more people out there. We haven't lost anything, have we?
No. It'd be nice to see an open wheeler category, but that's just me being an open wheeler nuffy. So,
F4s this weekend.
Yeah, well, we haven't got to hots and knots yet, Mark. Right, so let's just build up to that, shall we?
Good. You're talking about people needing to do things differently. There's probably one organisation that needs to do that, and that'd be Motorsport Australia, posting $1 million loss in the last financial year. That's pretty big.
Look, it's not ideal, is it? A lot of it driven off the back of travel expenses, and anyone that runs a business this day and age will understand that that's ridiculously expensive. But their number one cost driver through all of that was insurance increases, and that's unavoidable. So, yep, they need to find better ways of generating more revenue, no doubt about it, 100%. They've already announced a rate rise for license holders, which is frustrating, I'm sure, for people that are already spending a lot of money on motorsport. But that's what else are they going to do? They've got to find other ways to drag money into the sport to do it. So whether that's chasing more government funding, whether that's, you know, license increase, whether that's from a commercial side of things, certainly there are opportunities in that space that perhaps aren't being capitalized on at the moment. So it's not ideal, but as a member-based organisation, they have to be very transparent about that stuff. So it's probably good that we get that information, because there are businesses in our sport which don't tell you how much they're making or how much they're losing, and they can't be opened up to scrutiny like MA can.
So post-tax deficit of $1,060,928. Insurance went up $730,000.
That's a lot.
Which is a lot. So, you know, you said, you know, raise it, license fees. The problem is there that you raise the license fees, you're going to lose people who can't afford, you know, they might only race a couple of times a year. They'll go, bugger it, we're giving this away. So you'll wind up, you know, incrementally losing people there. Or the other thing is you cut your expenses. Like, do you start sacking staff or cutting off things that aren't generating the money for you, sort of thing, which would be a shame for a lot of their programs. You'd assume that they're having to have some sort of financial input into, like, all their different training programs and whatnot, which would cost a lot of money to facilitate.
And stuff like that, you can't win with that, because if you start cutting that stuff, that also might cause members to go, oh, well, why am I spending my money on being a license holder or membership? So I'll leave anyway. So they're in a position there where they really can't win. You know, you bump your license costs up. Yep, you might make more revenue, but you'll lose some people from it. Or you cut services, so people are disappointed with their service. They go, well, what am I paying for this for? Or you cut things that the governing body puts on and funds, and the same thing. So, yeah, it's sort of rocking a hard place, unfortunately, from that point of view. You're going to lose. People are going to get pissed off at some point, one way or another, unfortunately. The challenge is for the CEO and for his team to find ways to... I don't think it's not about cutting money. It's about finding ways to make more, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
That's you know, when businesses are struggling, it's often a case of not slashing costs. It's about trying to find ways to make more money to afford to do what you're doing.
Your NASCAR report, Mark? NASCAR. Before we get into that, we should also commiserate and send our condolences to Shane Van Gisbergen and his family after Shane lost his mum just over a week ago.
Yeah. It's tough when you're on the other side of the planet, isn't it?
Yeah.
That, the whole distance thing, that's a great shame. But Shane's been racing with his mum's name on his car for these last couple of weeks, which is a nice touch. And actually on him, early hot here, here's a stat for you. He's led three of his first four Cup Series starts, become the fourth driver to achieve this behind Bob Flock, AJ Foyt and Tommy Kendall. So not bad little company there, so... Well done. He had a bit of a battle at Dover on the weekend in the Xfinity Series, qualified nowhere, finished 18th, but he did finish with a clean car once again, and I think that's what it's all about at the moment, is just learning and logging laps and getting a feel for it all, and that's what he did there on the weekend. He kept it clean when a lot of people didn't. It was a heck of a race, actually. That was probably the pick of all the races on the weekend, was that Xfinity race. It was won by Martin Truex Jr.'s brother, Ryan Truex. After race, where absolutely everything happened. It was fantastic. In the Cup race, Denny Hamlin was able to hold off late charge by Kyle Larson in a pretty good race.
Hmm.
That's it.
That's it. Pretty IndyCar?
IndyCar. Scotty, what a bounce back. I'm going to, this was going to be one of my hots, but we'll talk about it now. What a comeback that was for Team Penske. After all of the dramas of the last week, with the disqualification from St. Pete and the issues at Long Beach and all the bad press, to come out and qualify first and second and then smote the field in the race in a really entertaining IndyCar race as well was pretty emphatic. And Scott McLaughlin is the king of Barber Motorsport Park. Back-to-back victories now. Really impressive drive to grab a victory. And amazingly, went into that round 27th and last in the championship and came out of it 9th. So IndyCar's so tightly stacked this year. There's only 1 point between the two leaders. There's nothing in it early on, and there's, you know, there's a dozen drivers covered by 50 or 60 points. So fiercely competitive stuff, but a really good car race too. It's the kind of race that Formula One would kill to have, where you've got one group of cars on one strategy going flat out and stopping three times, and another group of cars fuel saving, tyre saving, stopping twice. And you have absolutely no idea what one of that group is going to win until you get past the final pit stop. And it came down to yellows. It came down to all kinds of stuff playing out that the Penske cars on their three-stop strategy were able to blaze through. Alex Palou was on the two-stop and was on a really good chance to get third in that race, but got gobbled up in the closing few laps and ultimately tumbled down the order a little bit. But really entertaining car race, and almost despite itself, IndyCar continues to put on really great products on track at the moment, which is impressive. So I'm going to burn my main hot for the show this week by saying that, because despite all of the rubbish that goes on off track with IndyCar, their on-track product is still absolutely world's best example for entertaining motor racing, and they did it again at a racetrack that IndyCar shouldn't be. Wings and six open wheelers should not put on a good race at Barber.
Yeah.
In no circumstance should they do that. But every year, IndyCar goes there and puts on an absolute belter, which says a lot about the product they've got at the moment.
Well, let's not make it you burning your hot. Let's make that as your first hot of our hots and knots.
Okay, good. I don't actually have that many hots this week. I've got a few knots, though, which I'm looking forward to. But I'm going to throw a hot to South Australian Motorsport.
Ooh. Oh, surprise, surprise,
yeah, I know, right? It's shocking that I should get around South Australia. However, on the weekend, the Malala Historics were on, and by all accounts, very successful. This weekend is round three of the South Australian Motor Racing Championships at the Bend, which will include the opening round of Formula 4 Australia. More on that later.
Later? What would that mean, Richard?
I know. What? Maybe? So that's May 4 to 5. Then May 25-26, Shebex, is round four of the SA Motor Racing Championships. And that includes a round of the Toyota 86 Scholarship Series, which is going to have a massive grid on that the second tier Toyota 86s, which is great. The week after that is the Shannon Speed Series at the Bend Motorsport Park, which we've already talked about, which is huge. The week after that, 3 weeks in a row, on June 7, 8, and 9, is the next round of the SA Motorsport Series, which is the Lamborghini Super Trofeo Asia, which includes F4 Formula Open Prototype Series and a round of First Focus Radical Cup Australia, which is a bloody good program, actually. So a massive program at the Bend for South Australian motor racing fans. There really is no excuse to not get around it over the next couple of weeks. And the other thing is that the Speed Series will be live on the screens of Seven. All of the other ones will be broadcast live and free by our mates on Blendline.
Fantastic.
So I reckon you're going to get some pretty good car racing over that little period there at the Bend Motorsport Park. So
and check out the Race Talks TV guide for all the Blendline times, because I've been furnished with those.
Yes, very good. Very good. Coverage is excellent. You'll be surprised how much you can learn. That's about all the hots I've got. I'm just going to save myself a minute.
Well, then I'll just go with a single one as well, and then, Mark, you can bring us home. No, I won't. No, mine's more a knot.
Or is it a what, if you don't know where it sits?
No, it's, I think it's definitely a knot.
Okay, well, I'm glad.
It might be in purgatory there with Mascot Airport.
Horrible
good,
place.
Good news, hot. The Race and Rail is back for the Bathurst 1000, yay. 4 days, three nights, roll up on the vintage train Friday, back to Sydney 11 a.m. Monday morning, accommodation on board the train, Friday lunch, three breakfasts, general admission tickets to the track, and a bus transfer to the circuit. Hot, although it only costs a low price of $2,995 per person, which makes staying at the Ridges look quite hot. Doesn't it, really?
Just what was that price again? Sorry.
2,000, it starts with 2,995.
Yep. So $3,000.
Yeah.
To catch a train to Bathurst.
And to sleep on the train.
To sleep on the train.
Yeah, you get to sleep on the train.
What?
That's your accommodation.
I've got a train to Bathurst and it only cost me $25.
Yeah, I know, but did you sleep on the train for the
Well, I did for about 2.5 hours because I was pretty tired.
Different.
Interesting.
You heard it here first, unless, of course, you saw the same thing I did. McLaren is set to have a Marlborough livery for the Monaco Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, the team is releasing Marlboro-coloured merch in a bid to simply put podcasters off the trail, which in that case would be a knot. It was revealed this week on my social feed, at least, that Mercedes F1 made Nico and Lewis pay for damage after they crashed into each other, which is a great concept. Nico revealed that for one particular crash, he had to personally dolly up £360,000. Sucked in, ha 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 ha. I think that's hot.
That is so hot.
Ferrari throwing back to the old blue mechanic uniforms from a long, long time ago. Miami this week. Hey, Miami F1's back. Probably at a very reasonable time early on Monday morning. Hopefully they don't channel the old 3-minute long pit stops like Steak F1 have this year. Did you see the AI races on the weekend? The robot cars banging around Abu Dhabi?
Yeah.
No.
Brilliant.
Look, full disclosure, it was horrible.
Yeah.
But, this is the but, I think it's got potential, and hear me out here. So, you know, motorsport these days is just entirely dictated around safety, isn't it? You know, like Formula One cars, Indy cars, everything's, the speed's kept in check to keep things safe. You know, no drivers, no marshals, no fans, no cameramen. They can film this stuff on drones and in-car cameras, and they can make the things absolute ballistic weapons, like properly dangerous hot rods. I'd watch it ludicrously fast. You know, when they're going 500 k's an hour and they hit the blue screen of death and they knock over a grandstand, nobody gets hurt, but it makes a rad TikTok.
Like, can you imagine the tech companies not wanting to sponsor it, though? Like, if you're Windows, you are not sponsoring one of those cars. It's Team Windows Racing. Oh, it's crashed again. Oh, get the control alt delete out.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually my alternate universe dream. Like, I'd watch the Tour de France if it was just complete roid up people. Yeah. Like sports sedans riding across the French countryside at 300 k's an hour. Sports like sedans. I'd watch it. No rules. It'd be sick. Hot Country Fried Speedway. I ventured out to Rosedale on the weekend after the Anzac air show. So good. Ice cream truck, coffee van, canteen, playground for the kids, rad skids on a Saturday arvo.
Great bakery in Rosedale.
Is it?
Really good bakery.
I wouldn't know because I pigged out at the racetrack, so give that a go next time. Scotty McLaughlin's winning IndyCar this week was sponsored by Good Ranches, which I'm now glad to know is home-delivered meat, which is a concept I can absolutely get behind. Needs to be more of that sort of sponsorship in sport. Much Evans, Formula E win in Monaco. That's hot.
Yep.
Friend of this part of the universe. 99 starts here in Formula E. He's got 10 wins and 26 podiums. That's a pretty handy strike rate.
Yeah,
when you
he's
think
pretty
about
good at
it,
life. Yeah,
if nobody heard it, though, did it really happen?
Oh, no, it did happen. I saw it. It was a thing. Good on him. Hot. This coming weekend's part 5 of the deep dive into the Battle of Bathurst on the racetalk.com.
It's a good one, too.
The V8s versus Super Touring War. It's entitled Death Threats and Regrets. And I highly recommend it because it took me a long time to write. We're up to about 18,000 words now.
There's still two parts to go.
It's taking me a fair while.
And I'll tell you what, folks, he's working on another one, which is just going to be absolutely outstanding.
It is ridiculous. It's the second rabbit hole we've fallen into in quick succession here. It's a pretty deep one. And finally, on the racetalk.com, the TV guide last week had 69 live listings and was posted at 4:20 p.m. on Thursday. So we absolutely nailed all the important lucky numbers there. Fantastic.
Well, I did actually forget one hot Chebex, and I'm very sorry for Speedway fans because it was announced this week that the new Tolmer Speedway, which is yet to be named, which is the track down a border town, which conveniently is near the border of South Australia and Victoria.
Oh, yeah.
Might shock you to know. Which is going to be the wildest speedway in Australia. Incredible banking. We talked about it in the show last week. That was announced as being part of the Sprint Car Speed Week, which runs between Christmas and New Year over summer, which is great. So it'll start at Murray Bridge. It will then go to border town, Mount Gambier, across the border to Avalon and finish at Warrnambool on New Year's Day. So 5 speedway events in 7 days.
That's amazing.
It's going to be really cool. And that'll be the first major event at that epic new banked speedway in the southeast, which is going to be really cool. And TRT will be there for that one. I can guarantee you that's going to be terrific. Loves a bit of Speed Week action.
Nice.
Right. Knots.
Here we go. Here we go.
Here we go.
Oh, I don't want to build it up too much. They're not that great. Formula One points, in particular the discussion that they should be going to 12th place or indeed the whole field, as David Croft suggested, just because some teams aren't good enough, Alpine, to score world championship points this year, Sauber. No, absolutely not. What is this? Everyone gets a prize?
That's not how Formula One works.
For a long time, Formula One only awarded points to 6th position. Imagine how angry teams would be in Formula One this day and age if they only got points for 6th place. But some people seem to think that Formula One should award points all the way down the field because it looks bad because some teams haven't got points. I'm sorry. This is sport. If you're not good enough to get points, you don't deserve points. It is a hardcore knot that this is even being discussed. And David Croft, who suggested the whole field should get it, you should know better than that. Bad knot.
Excellent. Well done.
Suicidal mannequins are a knot.
Oh,
no.
What a knot.
How? How?
Exactly. How the hell does a mannequin end up falling off a bridge onto a racetrack in the middle of a live IndyCar race? Poor thing had its hand broken off as well. Very nearly altered the outcome of the race for Scott McLaughlin. Like, that was so close to screwing up what they had going on. But is that possibly the strangest reason for a full course yellow in car racing history? It's got to be right up there.
It got rescued by a crash, though, that
it did.
Brought out the yellow.
Correct. But strange things. Not. How did that happen? That is a not. Fantastic. Last week, I went to Wellington, as you do when you're in New Zealand. I'd never been there. I quite like the place. It's quite cool. It's got a cool vibe about it. The waterfront stuff is great. But what gets a massive knot is the lack of anything commemorating the Wellington Street Race, which was a significant part of New Zealand motor racing heritage. There is not a statue. There's not even a plaque commemorating it. And even the old grid marks on the old pit straight, which up until recently were very visible, are now very rapidly fading into oblivion. And there are a few very faint yellow marks there where the grid boxes used to be on the waterfront. The Wellington waterfront is really nice. It's a really cool place. There's bars, restaurants. Yep. It's really cool to walk around. They've done a really nice job of turning it into an area to go and visit based on what it looked like when they did run a street race through it, because it didn't look like a really good place. But it would be really nice to see some form of commemoration for what the street race did for Wellington and the promotion and some of the feats that went on there, which were pretty special. So I was really disappointed. There's not even a mention of it anyway. You would not know unless you're a nerd like me.
Well, I think you need to write a story on that and see if you can get
there is a story coming to the racetalk.com at some point in the near future. Because I walked the whole track, which was a good walk. Mountain biking, especially if you are a IndyCar driver by the name of David Malukas, because he went mountain biking. He came off his mountain bike, broke some bones, and as a result has been sacked by McLaren, lost his drive. As a result, there's been fill-in drivers for the first four races of this year's IndyCar Championship while they waited for Malukas's bones to bond themselves together, but they got past four races. He still wasn't ready to get back in the car, and the team exercised an option in his contract, which allowed them to separate from their driver, which they'd worked quite hard to sign out of this year. So Knotts get that, but also, gee, that's a pretty tough move from McLaren, isn't it? They made a pretty early decision to get rid of Malukas before he even turns a lap in a McLaren IndyCar, and it's not like they're having a banner season either at the moment in their IndyCar team. So it's just a blanket knot, but I blame the mountain bikes. Don't do fitness. It's bad for you. And my final knot is we now know why Lance Stroll is so rubbish and why he crashed into the back of Daniel Ricciardo in the Chinese Grand Prix. It's but clearly he is autonomous racing. Because it's exactly the same thing that happened at Abu Dhabi when two autonomous racing cars stupidly crashed into each other. It was interesting to watch the autonomous racing stuff, but it was really stupid, and it gets a knot from me.
Did one of the autonomous drivers say that the other driver was a something, something, something?
I believe it in zeros and ones. Yeah, I'm sure it did. I'm sure there was some really bad JavaScript being exchanged between them, but it was just stupid, and Daniel Kvyat was quicker than the AI, and you know, Daniel was a competent Formula One driver, but certainly never set the world on fire, so it doesn't say a lot about artificial intelligence and driving racing cars, does it? Yeah, not autonomous racing, not for me at this point in time.
What is the hot rod of it?
those things are amazing cars. So they're the Dallara Super Formula car with the same Honda power plant they run in Super Formula, and they're quicker than an F2 car, but they were rubbish. They were miles off the pace.
Mm.
Now, yes, they'll probably get them fast eventually, but I would get more out of that if it was a bunch of racing car drivers sitting in pit lane in a simulator driving the actual racing car on the racetrack.
I would actually get more out of it if they put the driver in the car, but he couldn't actually drive.
Oh, jeez.
Sat there.
God. God, it opens a whole new.
Wow.
Oh, God. Opens a
safety
whole new
first.
AI debate there, doesn't it? Anyway, it gets a knot from me. The broadcast was quite good, but it gets a knot.
The reason there was confusion in my hot or not before was I was going to hot the MotoGP Spanish Grand Prix and the fact that it had a record crowd. The reason it becomes a knot is because the number that they put out was all wrong. So in case you haven't heard, MotoGP put out a news event saying congratulations, 296,741 people at Jerez, beating the old record of 278,805, so 18,000 more. And then a little bit later in that afternoon, they had to put out a retraction saying, we might have made a little bit of a mistake. It was actually only 181,000, so 115,000 lower than the number that they actually put out. So hot for the original number and a not for the fact that it wasn't the right number.
There's some serious, it's like Winton, 2002 when they announced there was 85,000 people there and not great. I wonder how
do you get 85,000 people at Winton?
Well, exactly. But the previous MotoGP record crowd was at Le Mans last year. And I wonder how quickly the Le Mans promoter got on to Dorna and said, we don't think there's that many people at Jerez on the weekend, which was a shame because it was a really, really good MotoGP race as well, as is often the case. But
it was, but 115,000 less people saw it than should have.
Maybe the counter was drunk. I don't know.
It reminds me of a story when I used to commentate the National Soccer League, and you used to have the Melbourne Knights play South Melbourne, local derby. Melbourne Knights used to have a packed crowd, which was about 15,000-16,000 people. Absolutely, you couldn't move in the joint. You look at the Herald Sun on the Monday morning, official attendance, 6,270. And it was all because they had cash money at the door and they didn't want to pay extra tax. So they actually got the crowd by 9,000.
Brilliant. Very clever. Supreme dodginess. Right.
Very clever.
I think the same thing used to happen with the footy on the Gold Coast, because it came a point where they'd have to put on free buses if it was over 5,000 people there or whatever the deal was. And it's like, nah, we got 4,999 again. Can't believe it.
Great.
Bring us home, Mark.
All right. Adrian Newey, if indeed he is leaving Red Bull, and if indeed it is a case of fallout from the Christian Horner mad texting fiasco, then that's a pretty bad outcome for that team. Yeah. I guess the question has to be asked, how much of Adrian's DNA is actually in the current car, because he's supposedly splitting his time between that and the road car project thing that they've got going on. So hard to say how big a loss it would actually be. If the gardening leave clause is actually exercised, he'll be 70 by the time he's allowed to have a crack out the pencils once again. I mean, will he want to keep going on? He just bought himself a very big sailboat, so he might want to go and sail that thing around. If this is the first domino to fall, you know, is Max actually going to take up his gazillion-dollar deal at Mercedes? It's a big can of worms that has potential to sort of rock the whole boat there in a lot of different directions. So be interesting to see how all that sort of pans out.
$245 million a year, reportedly.
A lot of coin.
Mercedes deal.
Someone who is going to be on a fair bit of coin, Nico Hülkenberg. So he's been signed up for Audi. So let's think about it. Since 2010, he started 211 race weekends, zero podiums. His last win was in F2 on the 19th of September 2009. Valtteri Bottas, who may or may not be left at that team, 228 Grand Prix, 10 wins, 67 podiums, last win 2021 in Turkey. Look, I understand the need for a global automotive brand to have a German driving for them, but you know, Hülkenberg, really? If you need to have a token German driving for your Swiss-based team, why not pick a successful one like Vettel, Nico Rosberg, Keke Rosberg, Ralf Schumacher, Timo Glock. He had three podiums from 95 races. Hell, I'd bail Adrian Sutil out of wherever he is at the moment.
Keke Rosberg was a Finn, by the way.
Oh, he was half German.
No, he visited Germany once.
That's why Nico's half German.
Yeah.
Rosberg was as Finnish as they get. Anyway.
Sure.
I agree.
Yeah. I do not understand that. But anyway, tough week for Lance Stroll. You brought it up there, Rich. He's been shafted by the fact that it wasn't consecutive race weekends, so he couldn't escape the taunts of the internet. The cruelest jab that I saw in my travels this week regarding that Chinese GP stack was that he was distracted when he crashed into Dan Ricciardo because he was absentmindedly picking his nose because Formula One cars don't have windows to lick.
Wow.
Look, the big actual loser in this is Aussie sporty legend Scotty James, who's married to Lance's sister, but is also really good mates with Dan. So how do you think he's feeling at the moment? He's sort of stuck in a rock, between a rock and a hard place.
Interesting. Backside sore for sitting on the fence. Yeah.
Awkward. Interestingly, FM radios are not. Then there's IndyCar and Penske. Oh, boy, that was a big week there, wasn't it? You know, Joseph Newgarden got out there. Was quite
Hang on. FM radio. Ah, oh, okay. Yeah, no, carry on. Sorry. Carry on.
Yep. Newgarden, very emotional, long-winded press conference. And frankly, you could probably believe everything he said. Like, it didn't sound like a fabrication, the things that he said. You know, in essence, he basically said it was a misunderstanding. He didn't understand it. He thought that they'd changed the rules and he could push the pass button when you're not allowed to. Colton Herter, in response, noted that at the time of St. Pete, he clipped the video he's on board of Joseph absolutely smashing the restarts, going, "Boy, those Chevys sure have something trick going on in the restarts there. He absolutely hosed us." And he circulated to his friends. And then he went on to say, "It's said in every driver's briefing where overtake is allowed. He's driven the car for how long? I don't feel bad at all. I don't know how you cannot know the rules. I just don't understand that for somebody who's been in the series for 10 years that they could make that mistake." Zach Brown from his side of McLaren there. "The team of that caliber, to have an oversight of that magnitude doesn't seem right. The team and the drivers are too good to say we didn't know the rules. We didn't know it was there. It was an oversight. None of that stacks up when something like that happens. You just have to own it," which is probably a point too. Scotty McLaughlin came out and claimed that he didn't gain a time advantage. Well, he must have had a terrible restart going because he had his finger on the button for 50 extra horsepower for 1.9 seconds. How does that not give you an advantage? If it was a placebo button, you wouldn't press it, but you're getting 50 extra horsepower. So of course you're getting an advantage. Let's assume it was an honest mistake, but Penske would never cheat, right? Except for last month when they cheated and got caught in NASCAR when Joey Logano had his web gloves, and all the other times in their NASCAR history that they've been caught cheating and thrown out of races. So it's not like they're a squeaky clean organisation there when you have a bit of a dig back through their rap sheet over the years. And then there's the fact that IndyCar took so long to catch them. And if they weren't caught on Sunday morning at Long Beach, they would have run the system again in the race there. So it would have just made the mess even bloody worse. It's a bad look for Penske. It's a bad look for the Penske-owned IndyCar. Honda, they're teetering on the edge at the moment, and they've come out and said that it's a bad look. So super awkward for everyone. It's a shame that that happened, and we're talking about that rather than good things. And that's it, actually, because we've covered everything else of it. That bloody mannequin, I don't get it. How?
Yeah, no, that was stupid. The only other knot I skipped, and we buried the lead a little bit here, is a preemptive potential knot for Formula 4 this weekend. Does anybody know what's happening with F4 this weekend?
No.
Does F4 stand for four cars?
Well, potentially.
The National Series had a second round of the year last weekend at Winton.
No, Formula 4.
Oh, four, sorry. Four, it's all the new series. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, yes, but no, does anyone know? Because well, as we talk, we're 4 days out from them hitting the racetrack, and I couldn't tell you who's running in it, let alone how many cars there are.
Drivers?
You'd think that a series looking to reintroduce itself in the Australian marketplace with a new international promoter trumpeting things like Ferrari Driver Academy access and things like that for top five drivers. I don't know. I I would just think you'd be a little bit more proactive in telling your story, wouldn't you? Maybe.
100%.
Maybe I don't know much about how PR works, but the lack of promotion for it is shocking. So
where are they racing?
At the Bend, Chebex.
Okay.
Yep. You'll be able to watch it on Blendline TV. I'll be there. I will report for the race talk with what happens. But the silence is deafening at this point. It's going to be really interesting to see exactly what happens.
Nice finish. Great work, boys. Catch you next week.
Ciao for now.
Look forward to that Formula 4 report next week. That's going to be fun.
Well, yeah, just give us a bit of extra time in the knots, I fear.
Will do. See you, Mark. See you, Richard.
Bye-bye.
And we'll catch you too next time right here on The Grid.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production.
Tell your friends there's more at RadioLeMans.com.